Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, February 18th. This morning, we turn our attention to Haleakala, where Maui residents are being asked to weigh in on the military's plan to build more than a half a dozen telescopes. There's a meeting later tonight. We hear more about a climate report that points to last year as the second driest on record. And it's been a dry season for the film industry, too. We head to the Hawaii premiere of a movie filmed here in the islands. Are more productions on the horizon? On this week's Mono Minute, we meet a powerful flying bird adapted to the desert, and Lunar New Year traditions abound for longevity and good fortune. Had your fix of mochi yet? We take a tour of a small business that's been busy churning out sweet treats for decades. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The future of telescopes in Hawaii are in the spotlight this week. The University of Hawaii Board of Regents takes up issues around leases at Mauna Kea tomorrow as a Management and Stewardship Authority gets input from the community about the future of the mountain there on the Big Island. And this morning, we turn our attention to Maui. The U.S. Air Force is gathering input about the future of Haleakala. There was pushback at last night's meeting in Kihei. Tonight, there's a second gathering in Pukalani to hear from residents who live closer to the summit. Colleen Ueche is the editor of the Hawaii Journalism Initiative. She's been tracking the activity on Haleakala and joins us this morning. Good morning, Colleen.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yes, so you've been taking a closer look at what the plans are for Haleakala, and, you know, there is this meeting tonight.
Yeah, so basically what the Air Force is wanting to do is they want to build seven more telescopes on the summit of Haleakala. And, you know, if you've been there, there's a bunch of facilities there that are known as Science City, basically. And it involves a lot of facilities from the University of Hawaii, as well as the military. And they use these telescopes for academic and defense purposes. And so Haleakala is known to Native Hawaiians as Laukua, the realm of the gods. And so it's a very sore spot for many people to have these facilities at the summit, which is a sacred place. And so these tensions are coming to a head at these meetings where the Air Force is bringing these project plans to the community, and the community is giving their feedback. There was a meeting last night, and there's one more tonight.
Well, you know, the last time I was up there was to cover the opening of the Daniel K. Inouye Solar Telescope. And, you know, that was hailed as, you know, really adding so much to science, to research. But talk more about what the military is planning.
Yeah, so what the military wants to do with their telescopes, they're saying they need it because they continuously need advancing technology so they can keep an eye on what's happening in space. You know, they want to, you know, track satellites and near Earth objects and other things that are happening up there. And because technology in other countries are putting so much up in space, you know, they say there's growing national security threats and they need to keep tabs on these things. And for people last night at the meeting, that was a very frustrating reason. They said national security is just a catch-all term for an unknown, you know, type of threat that we'll never fully understand, you know, here as civilians. And as a community, they felt like it was an excuse to put these telescopes up there when there are already so many facilities on the summit.
Well, why do they need seven?
Well, they're all going to be working together to, you know, all these different purposes. And, you know, honestly, I think a lot of people don't understand why they need seven more. There's already several facilities up there. There's academic telescopes, there's defense telescopes. And so I think for people, it's, you know, kind of baffling why more are needed.
Well, yes. And on the Big Island at Mauna Kea, right, the concern and the pushback was over the 30-meter telescope because it was so large. But yeah, I'm sure, you know, that does beg the question, why so many? And if they can reduce the footprint, you know, why don't they do that?
Yeah, and I think because of what happened with Mauna Kea, there were so many protests, they managed to, halt the project. And I think that was, a lot of people saw that as a big victory. And so I think people on Maui are surprised and frustrated that the military is going forward with these plans, considering there was so much opposition, this telescope on Mauna Kea, and they don't understand why there continue to be more plans for telescopes there. I remember the protests back in Haleakala is a little bit of a different story than Mauna Kea, because the biggest telescope up there did end up going forward. There were huge protests a decade ago. I remember sitting on the highway in the middle of the night watching as people lay down in the road. They were chained together. They were trying to stop the delivery of parts for this solar telescope, and it still managed to go forward. And now the largest solar telescope in the world is on the summit of Haleakala. And for scientists, it's a very useful and, unprecedented tool in terms of, being able to study the sun. But for Native Hawaiians and the Maui community that protested against it, it's a very frustrating symbol to see on the top of the mountain.
Well, your article talks about how this site is less than an acre, but, there was that chemical spill up there, right? And I don't know if the military has completed the cleanup of the area.
They haven't. It's been 3 years now, and that's part of the reason why, again, people are upset, because the fuel spill was a reminder of the many frustrating ways in which, the military has impacted the land here in Hawaii. We had the infamous fuel leak on Oahu at Red Hill as well. And so this one was smaller, but it didn't matter the size. The impact was, what really upset people. And that's still ongoing, the cleanup. They recently got their plans for fully cleaning up the area approved last year by the Department of Health. And that's still moving forward, but it could take years, honestly. They told, some media outlets that it could take up to 2032 to finish cleaning that area. And that's honestly longer than it would take them to build the telescopes that they're planning right now.
Wow. It'll be interesting to see, what else comes up at tonight's meeting. But thank you so much, Colleen, for tracking this.
Thank you, Kathy.
That was Colleen Oeche talking with us about the plans for more telescopes on a Maui mountaintop. Look for her story at mauinow.com. And tonight's meeting is at the Mayor Hannibal Tavares Community Center in Pukalani from 6 to 9 p.m.
Support for HPR comes from KTA Superstores, committed to supporting Hawaii food producers and makers. Learn more about its locally sourced Mountain Apple brand products at ktasuperstores.com.
There will be this sort of new kind of company that is emerging with AI work at the center of it. And I think that's going to be a really fast-growing part of the economy. I think the job market impacts that we're starting to see hints of today will become much clearer a year from now.
I'm Natalie Kitroev. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Olson Trust, envisioning a Hawaii where its people are supported by the land, and the land is taken care of by its people. OlsonTrust.com.
You know, 2025 was the second driest year in Hawaii in more than a century. That's one of the key findings of a recent report from the Hawaii Climate Data Portal that aims to make climate data more accessible to the public. University of Hawaii climate scientist Ryan Longman spoke with HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote about how Hawaii's environment may be changing.
Most of the data is fragmented. So you have a little bit here, you have a little bit there. There's really no place that kind of acts as a central hub to bring all the data together. And that's kind of one of the earliest missions with our group and with this project, was to kind of bring things together so folks didn't have to go to multiple places, look at different formats of data, try to homogenize them in ways where they were relevant and comparable this kind of does all that work for you.
And you folks have released your first, it is your first annual report, correct?
Yes, it's the first annual report. It's taken us a long time to get to this point to be able to put out a product like this. It's something that we've been aspiring to for many years.
How does releasing this annual report align with the overall mission of the Hawaii Climate Data Portal?
Well, what we did was we tried to create a report that was in plain language. So really anybody could take a look at it, understand the maps, understand the graphs, look at some of the key statistics. It wasn't meant to overwhelm anybody. It was meant to come at them in a way where they could, you know, interpret it, understand it, and relate it to their own lives. And the year that they had, it was a pretty hot and dry year. And I think everybody saw that. And this kind of just put some numbers behind that and shows just how hot and dry it was.
Delve a little bit more into those findings that you include in the report, looking at 2025.
Yeah, well, some of the key findings were that we found that it was the second driest year in the last 106 years. And that's looking at the entire state. When we go down to individual islands, we see that Maui had its driest year in the last 106 years, and Hawaii Island was the second driest. The southern part of the island chain really got hit hard. Some of the northern islands, it was also dry, but not as dry as those islands. Some other key statistics, we saw that 11 out of the 12 months for rainfall were drier than usual. We saw that for temperature, which we have a shorter time series with the maps, but we did find that it was the sixth warmest year on record. That was, you know, an average across the state, but on Maui and Hawaii and even Oahu, we saw it was the third or fourth warmest year on record. And all of the months were above average in terms of what they normally are.
And Ryan, you said you wanted to put forward, you and your colleagues wanted to put forward this data to back up what people had experienced, the dry, hot year that people in Hawaii have had. Can you talk a little bit more beyond the data about what that experience is actually like for people under these conditions?
What comes to my mind right away is we work with ranchers and we work with the Hawaii Cattlemen's Council, and we find out a lot of stories on the ground. And, you know, we found that the ranchers had a really hard time this last year. For the first time in many years, they had to purchase a lot of water to keep their herds alive, to keep, you know, supplement feeding. And it was one of the hardest years on record for them. So that's one of the on the ground things that we've seen. I think also just day to day, you hear people say, oh, it's really hot or it's really dry. We need rainfall. We need to keep vegetation alive. And when you look at the numbers, you look at the drought, you look at the statistics, you see that, you know, even in December, looking back a year, 65% of the state was either abnormally dry or even worse. And that's quite a bit, you know, considering, you know, we have these really lush windward sides of the island, and even they were dried up.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Hawaii experienced its second driest year in over a century. About 65% of Hawaii was classified as abnormally dry or worse. At this time, can we determine through the data that you and your colleagues have collected if we are seeing a permanent trend towards a drier Hawaii?
Well, that's the report doesn't show trends, and we're hoping to do that next year. And we have some preliminary work done on that. But what we can tell you from the report is that four of the five driest years have all happened in the last decade. So we can see that potentially there is a trend of more drying. And some other research has shown that this last decade was the driest on record. We've seen significant increases in drought magnitude, so the intensity of drought and the duration of drought, like how long droughts are lasting. So there's other evidence out there that's supporting that, you know, we are moving into this drier climate.
You talked about how the mission overall of the Hawaii Climate Data Portal and the presentation of this annual report is to make it accessible. What applications do you think this data has? What audiences are you targeting?
I think one thing the report does is it connects people to the resources that, you know, they can take a deeper dive on. You know, they can get the data to make resource management decisions. The report is basically an overview of what happened last year, but it connects to this bigger, you know, hub of information. So folks can use it for various reasons. We're hoping, you know, on the simplest level that folks can just connect and see that this data is accessible and that they can understand it. But also we can see how this and other products we're developing can be used for education, for getting children at all ages connected to climate information, understanding how things are changing through time. And then really on the applicable on the ground resource management level, we're hoping that folks can use data and information to actually make resource management decisions. So prioritizing maybe when or where they might do some restoration activities in the ranching sector. You know, we have some tools that allow ranchers to analyze forage growth and think about how they might, moving into a drier year, purchase an insurance product or potentially manage their feeding for their herds, supplement feeding or purchase water, whatever the case might be. And we're hoping that this allows folks the information they need to make decisions that they're ultimately going to have to make. And so it's just another piece of information to help them make those decisions.
You mentioned earlier that this is something that you and your colleagues had been wanting to do for a long time. What did it actually take to compile this report?
Well, we've been developing the Hawaii Climate Data Portal for almost a decade, if you look at the background work that's been done on this. We've also had the establishment of the Hawaii MesoNet, which is a network of 100 climate stations across Hawaii. And that's given us this really high quality data in places where that data did not exist before. So that's allowed us to make better quality maps. We've also just recently created the drought product, which was a long time in the making. So that's allowed us to put that in the report as well. So we had a few pieces of it for a couple of years now, but we finally kind of crossed that threshold where we said, hey, we have enough data. We have enough data coming in from the Hawaii MesoNet to really put together a quality product and to be able to build on that and for future years to come.
And what's the main funding source for the Hawaii Climate Data Portal?
Right now, a bulk of it is being funded through the NSF Change Hawaii project that's administered at UH. We do have some supplemental smaller grants that help fund some of the decision support tools and some of the products we're developing. But ultimately, it's all a grant-funded project. So we're continually looking for resources to help move that forward. The state has stepped up. The Commission on Water Resource Management has provided some funding for the Hawaii MesoNet. And right now we're looking at opportunities to potentially get some money from the green fee or potentially some type of larger budget item that really kind of takes what we've built here with the MesoNet and Hawaii Climate Data Portal and makes it more secure into the future.
And over the last year, we've seen murky waters for a lot of different climate funding projects that are supported by federal funds. The Pacific Islands Climate Adaptation Science Center, for instance, had its funding award lapse. Researchers approached the legislature last year to create a climate hub within SOEST, the School of Ocean and Earth Science and Technology, and they said that continued collection of climate data at the local level is critical. What, in your mind, do climate researchers such as yourselves need to be able to continue to do the work that you're doing?
Well, I mean, a significant amount of time is spent writing grants and trying to access money to keep what we see as a viable and valuable commodity for this state, for education, for resource management. A lot of time is spent just trying to keep the lights on. With some type of dedicated funding or state support or dedicated green fee funding, we could spend a little less time on trying to keep the lights on and more time on making the lights more efficient and, you know, putting up new lights. And hopefully that analogy hits well here. But the reality of it is we can't really count on the federal government anymore to provide us with data and information. There's a lot of good people working for the federal government and there's a lot of devoted people, but the systems have broken down in that regard. Data that was once available is no longer available. It's harder to get data. It's harder to communicate with folks at that level. So when you establish a network like we have for the Hawaii MesoNet, it's one of a kind in the country in terms of the scale and the amount of stations that we have. And when you have all that data and you're able to do things with it, like create the maps and make it available the way we're doing it, you really build resilience at that local level and you're not dependent on any outside resources. If you have dedicated people like we do and a host of data that allows you to build tools and provide resources to folks on the ground, then you're going to have a more resilient community that kind of all sticks together and is not dependent on outside resources that are subject to go away at the blink of an eye.
We've been hearing from UH climate scientists Ryan Longman and HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote. We'll have online links to the Hawaii Climate Data Portal's interactive website later today.
Aloha. Join me, Nara Nellis, on After Hours, Hawaii Public Radio's new weeknight, late night music space, where each night brings a different host, sound, and point of view after dark. Every Monday, I host Electronic Soul, blending electronic, new disco, new age, and soul. Music to soundtrack your life, After Hours, Monday from 10 p.m. to midnight on HPR One.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
The new film, The Wrecking Crew, is the latest big-budget production set in the islands. Many scenes were shot here on Oahu. The action-packed cop comedy stars Hawaii's Jason Momoa, but does it signal a return of film and television productions to our state? HPR's Russell Subiono spoke with actors and industry advocates about making The Wrecking Crew and what comes next for Hawaii's film industry.
So, you two have been chasing murderers in a minivan?
Yeah. Yeah, he blew up my other car.
Yeah, that's not what happened. Doesn't surprise me at all.
Literally, what happened?
No, it's not. I actually saved your life. Remember when I saved your life? How cool that was?
Can you two shut up, please? I'm trying to focus back here. That's what I've been doing.
Oh, dude, trust me. I know. I live with him.
Thanks for saving my life, man.
You're welcome.
So heroic of you.
That's a clip from The Wrecking Crew, the Jason Momoa action comedy that dozens of people were lined up to see at its recent premiere in Kapolei. It stars Jason Momoa and former professional wrestler De Bautista as estranged brothers who team up to investigate their father's death. Throughout the film, viewers will recognize many familiar landscapes like Makapu'u Beach and H3 Highway. That's because the film was shot in Hawaii and New Zealand in late 2024, right before film and TV production work in our state ground to a halt. A bill introduced during the 2025 legislative session hoped to breathe new life into the industry by expanding film tax credits, but that died in session. Still, it didn't seem to damper the spirits at the premiere. The atmosphere was celebratory, the vibe, excitement.
Yes, I was so excited to answer the casting call and was accepted.
That's local teacher Auntie Liz Santa Anna. She was one of the dozens of Oahu residents hired as a background actor. At the premiere, she was wearing a lei po'o, a headlay, and mingling with others that she met on set. Her step was lively, and she had a big smile on her face. It was the first time she'd ever been in a movie.
First, I was supposed to be at the airport scene. I packed the luggage and the dress for the part, but last minute, they sent me to NYKiki for 6 hours, yelling, "Vote for Mahoy!"
Also among the local actors cast was Cindy Mayo Akeo. She's scored roles in the past in big productions like the Magnum P.I. reboot and several local films. In The Wrecking Crew, she plays the medical technician in the scene where Dave Bautista's character IDs his late father's body.
Did you have any nerves? I mean, this is a big movie with some big, big stars. Did you have any nerves or anything? What would it feel like when you got to set?
I felt really comfortable in front of the camera. Sometimes in your mind you're like, oh my God, will I remember my lines? But David did not have any lines. I was the one that had to carry the scene. So it was that was a little nerve-wracking. However, I did see that he also was like trying to think about what is my motivation, and he was even asking the director that, and that made me feel comfortable because I was like, oh, if he's asking for a direction in a small little scene like this, then it just totally made my nerves go away, and I was like, okay, here we go. Action, let's do this.
Also in the film, Jacob Batalon, the Damien Memorial School graduate who made a name for himself playing Peter Parker's best friend Ned in the recent Spider-Man films, and Maya Kealoha, Lilo from last year's Lilo and Stitch, plus acting veteran Branscombe Richmond.
This is an important movie for all Native Hawaiians, Native people, period. And that's what's really, really great.
Richmond is a longtime Maui resident and was cast as mobster Mr. K in the film. He's been in the film and TV industry for over 50 years, starting out as one of the first Polynesian stuntmen in Hollywood, then transitioning to acting and producing. In that time, he's seen the landscape change for Polynesians in the industry.
The world sees Hawaii as an aloha shirt, white pants, and hula dancers. What you get to see here is you get to see where we live, you know, which is important. You got to see where we live because there's a culture involved. And it's not just a Hollywood culture, and it's just not a culture of things that are plastic with, you know, plastic glaze.
I know this is your 52nd year in the movie business. What does it mean to have been in so many locally produced productions in recent years? Chief of War, Hawaii Five-0, Wrecking Crew, especially in Polynesian roles. What does it mean to you after so much time in the industry that this is where things are at?
It means a lot to me. I'm third generation. My father's from Tahiti. And he was the first guy. I mean, he used to take me on the set when I was a small kid on Mutiny on the Bounty, and there's Marlon Brando and Trevor Howard and Richard Harris. And here we are telling the stories of Polynesia. I do a lot of kids' stuff, And for them, they don't know Renegade, or they don't know Hard to Kill, or they don't know Commando. They don't know any of that stuff. But what they do know is maybe they know these family films, and they go, wow, there's a Polynesian guy there. So to me, that means something because they all have dreams too.
But local talent with dreams of a career on screen may have to go elsewhere. At one point in the 2010s, there were multiple network series and films shooting in our islands and competing for talent and crew. But the most recent network series to film here, Fox's Rescue High Surf, was canceled in 2025. Before that, NCIS Hawaii shuttered in 2024 after three seasons filming on Oahu. Both shows cited financial reasons for cancellation. So where are we in 2026?
Well, you know, it's indicative of what happened to Chief of War when we shot in Hawaii, where the majority of the production ended up going to New Zealand. I start with that only because it does reflect what happened last year where there was no work for the industry. It's just basically died.
That's film producer Angie LaPrette. She grew up in Hawaii. Most recently, she was a producer on The Wrecking Crew and last year's Chief of War. She's also the co-founder of the Hawaii Film Alliance and the International Culture and Arts Network, or ICANN. She was at The Wrecking Crew premiere, but I missed my opportunity to talk to her. It was a really busy event. So I dialed her up a few days later.
What we needed to do as a state is really step up and become competitive with other countries and states. And actually, Hawaii is really competing with Australia and New Zealand. That's usually our main competition that we have, mainly because it can double for Hawaii in a certain way. So last year, no shows came to Hawaii. I believe that many were waiting to see what was going to happen this year with our incentives. And as a result, we are seeing a couple of films and shows starting up right now at the start of 2026, which is really great.
So what does Hawaii have to do to become more competitive in attracting film and TV productions? We can't easily change the cost of housing and labor in our state. So many argue that we have to increase the incentives, mainly the film tax credit that allows productions to recoup some of the costs of filming here. Governor Josh Green addressed it in his recent State of the State address.
We know that the creative economy, like film, has been a powerful engine for local jobs when it's designed specifically to hire and train local people. That's why in 2026 and beyond, my proposal is to expand stackable film tax credits for productions that hire local crew and local talent.
So what did LaPrette think of Governor Green's statement?
The film industry is a business. That's all they look at is numbers. And how are we going to get the most bang for our buck? And that is a huge part of why shows do not shoot their whole show in Hawaii. They go away because they can maximize their numbers elsewhere. And they get what they can out of Hawaii, and that's mainly exteriors because We are unique to that, and as well as our weather. Now, so grateful to what Governor Green came out with, and very positive. It makes us much more competitive with other states now, and studios, and everybody will start looking at us. And I will say that, you know, it is not something that just came up. It's a lot of work that went on behind the scenes and talking with Governor and the senators and the House and everybody, just really to understand our business. And, you know, Jason, we're also in those meetings when we were doing Chief of War. It's a big deal to lift these numbers up.
Legislative attempts to expand Hawaii's film tax credit have been met with opposition in recent years. The idea of giving millions of dollars back to Hollywood doesn't sit well with some lawmakers and residents. But LaPrette sees it differently.
It's not true. I see the optics, and you know, it's all about educating our legislators and even the public, you know, who's looking at it that way. But the reality is, it's absolutely a circular economy here and what we need to really think about is sustainability, because what it does is it puts locals to work. It puts vendors to work. It impacts all industries across the board, including tourism. And I don't know why it's not that easy to understand, because for us, we see it, we hear it. We work with these business owners, small business owners, you know, and they're so grateful when we come into town or when shows come into town, because people go to restaurants and spend a lot of money. They go shopping. It's all of that. And so I think it's really just understanding how it really works internally when shows do come to Hawaii. And the other side of that is when it is a bigger show, it puts a lot more people to work and a lot more money pumped into the economy. So whether small or big, it affects Hawaii in a positive way.
Some of those positive effects were evident the night of the Wrecking Crew premiere. Smiles and laughs and hugs exchanged throughout the evening. And for somebody like Auntie Liz Santa Anna, who got the chance to be part of a major movie for the first time, maybe a potential new career?
Do you want to do more, you think? Do more movies?
Yes, if they accept a kupuna like me. Sure.
Right on. Thank you so much.
That was HPR's Russell Subiono talking with local actors and film industry advocates about efforts to boost Hawaii's film industry. Jason Momoa's latest movie, The Wrecking Crew, is streaming now on Amazon Prime Video.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
AI is supposed to make our jobs easier, meaning that we should be able to do more faster, right?
We're not going to know for some time what the productivity impacts of AI are, in part because it's going to be really hard to measure.
I'm Amy Scott, AI and Productivity, next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Life Real Estate Brokers, serving Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and the Big Island of Hawaii. Listings and information at hawaiilife.com.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We now go to this week's Manu Minute. Thanks to Zeno Kanto, we've got the calls of an introduced desert game bird with a unique adaptation like no other. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to an amazingly powerful flyer that has adapted well to Hawaii Island.
Chestnut-bellied sand grouse are one of our many game birds that were introduced to Hawaii for hunting.
Perhaps because they're native to the deserts of southern Sahara and India, they're able to do well and can only be found in the driest parts of Kohala on the Big Island. In addition to their chestnut-colored bellies, males and females are mostly mottled brown with a distinctive black necklace across their breast and a wingspan of about 2 feet. With their small heads and long pointed wings, they really stick out from any other game birds you might see in the area. Chestnut-bellied sand grouse eat mostly grass and weed seeds, and if you're lucky, you might see or even hear them overhead as they fly in small flocks between their foraging and roosting grounds. One really interesting characteristic of sand grouse is that the males have specially adapted feathers on their breast that allows them to soak up water like a sponge from far-off ponds and puddles and then carry it back to their thirsty nestlings. These little birds can then drink up to 4 teaspoons of water just by squeezing their dad's feathers with their bill. No other birds can do this, which is perhaps why chestnut-bellied sand grouse are so successful in the driest part of Hawaii. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society, working to protect Hawaii's native birds through programs and projects such as its Kolea Count. Learn more about programs and volunteering at hiaudubon.org.
Hawaii Public Radio brings the community together through our multi-platform Live from the Atherton event series. From jazz to classical, Hawaii Public Radio showcases local musicians in an intimate studio setting. We also welcome authors to host readings and discussions about their work.
This is a story, a mo'olelo. It's not really my story, but it involves me. Sometimes as a subject, sometimes as an unwitting object, sometimes as an unwilling participant. A mo'olelo that does not involve the teller is almost worthless. Just about as worthless as a story that is only about the teller.
Can't join us in person? Watch previous performances online on hawaiipublicradio.org/watch.
Family-owned mochi shop is gearing up for the festivities around Lunar New Year, where it's common to swap sweet treats with family. The Conversation's Maddie Bender recently took a trip to Fujia, Hawaii, which has been in business since 1953. She spoke with the owner, Devin Wong, and his son Tyler about keeping these sweet traditions alive.
Inside Fujia, Hawaii, desserts are piled nearly to the ceiling. Manju sweet buns, white rabbit-flavored chichidango, bags of senbei crackers, and butter mochi fill racks. A worker is packaging brownie mochi with a chocolate ganache into neat pairs. Because Valentine's Day and Lunar New Year holidays come back-to-back, owner Devin Wong wants to make sure the small shop will be able to ramp up production to sell hundreds of platters per day. We begin our tour at an industrial mochi machine from Japan.
How would you even describe what this machine looks like?
Pretty large. It has to have a big capacity. We do about, per day, probably about over 500 pieces of mochi. So it has to have a good copper pot. The good thing about that is before olden days, to have it without being turned, you'll do everything mixing by hand and a lot of backbreaking, you know, chores. Other people that do smaller versions will just do things in the microwave. So they're just doing a little bowl and stirring and stuff like that. But ours is a, you know, proprietary recipe that we've had since 1953, and we've been keeping it pretty steady. So either people like it, you know, that is pretty soft. But hard to really describe. It's silver, and it has a copper pot, and has a big mixer. So this is actually the part that will go in and turn everything. Pretty much 3 ingredients, water, sugar, and then flour. So it's a sweet rice flour.
Next, Devin brings us over to the machine that makes senbei. Fujiya is one of only two makers in the islands of the traditional Japanese rice crackers.
It's a gas machine that looks like a UFO. It's right behind us. No one wants to be in the hot place while the gas operates, so it does have plates. There's 10 plates that will turn. The person that does assembly will be just sitting there stationary. They do about 3 batches a day. So you're sitting on the machine for at least 3 hours at a time. Okay, so the 10 plates will rotate to you, and then you're gonna just take it off and then put it in a tray. That also has to cool down. So something like the Amen Senbei is one of our Lunar New Year's. It symbolizes kind of like our Amen cookie. So it's an Amen flavored. It's a thin Senbei wafer cracker, and then it actually has, we put a dot on it. Yeah, Chinese usually during Lunar New Year's has an almond cookie, so thicker, but it kind of looks the same to that. So we just kind of mimic different things for them. So senbei, why it's special to us is that there's only 2 people making senbei now in Hawaii. It's kind of a dying art, just kind of like mochi actually too, believe it or not. So we want to keep that tradition, keep on going with Fujiya, keep the recipes, keep the people coming and enjoying, the younger generation coming and enjoying.
In their office, Devin and his son Tyler share their first memories of mochi.
I'm from the Windward side, and I even asked my parents where they got mochi, but a lot of times when I grew up, and which is a lot longer before, I would be eating a lot of chichidango, and that's something that you can find at a supermarket, you can find different purveyors, but it was always available. It was always at your potlucks, and that was something easy. So that's kind of like my first memory of eating that, like, red and white chichidango. And that was, again, maybe 45 years ago. So I love it. It's just soft. And I think, you know, what I like is that no matter kind of who makes it, mochi is something you can enjoy no matter who makes it. And I'm glad that a lot of people are trying to do it and prolong, you know, the history of this.
Well, I feel like you're both the professionals in terms of how mochi should taste. So could you maybe just describe what the difference is between truly handmade fresh mochi and some of these other desserts versus what people might be getting if they buy it at a supermarket or have it imported?
So they're smaller batches. They're made fresh. Not to knock others, it's just that when you know you made it and you make the batches smaller and you're always able to just bring it out, you know, mochi doesn't have a long, long shelf life, but ours is a little softer. Eating it fresh, I think the difference is others can be a little hard. Like I said, sometimes people can make it because they're making a really small batch and they don't have that pot from Japan. They make it out of the microwave. So theirs might get a little harder, faster.
Yeah, I think I noticed our mochi is softer compared to like other people's and like Japan, but I think it's, I guess, because we don't use any preservatives at all, so it just, like, a lot of customers are surprised when we say, oh, you can put it in the fridge and it'll stay soft, because of, I guess, others tend to get hard in the fridge. But yeah,
Devin, when you took over the business, what did you change 5 years ago?
When I first came, actually, two stories. I came and I love the people here, first of all. I like their passion to work hard, stay long, backbreaking hours. But I wanted to make sure that customers came in knowing that after 11 o'clock, they had something to get. Because we were open to 3. So when I first came, the shelves were empty. So we had to make a change as far as how can we make more production in an efficient way. We are a business as well. So if you don't have a lot to sell, you can't really run a business, or you won't be in business very long. So, you know, more step-by-step instructions for people, training. We did a lot of that because I wanted to focus on, again, quality too and consistency for the product. So those were my main things, but we had to grow the business. And that was my main goal, is having awareness. So one thing with Tyler and I is we actually said, let's open up the marketing and open social media. It could be any radio, it could be TV, it could be newspaper, and then just social media that, again, our clients are tend to be a little on the older side, but then with the bring in the younger generation would be social media.
That's an interesting point, that not only is it an aging craft in terms of who's doing it, but also who might be consuming it. So Tyler, as the person who's kind of taken the helm on marketing, what are you trying to do to get more young people interested? Is there some education involved? Like, do people not even know about what you're making?
I guess so. Well, like, everyone's had kind of like mochi at like family parties during like New Year's and Christmas, but I guess the biggest thing is a lot of people don't like my age don't like red bean and like white bean mochi. So what I've done is like chocolate brownie, or even like a couple months ago we did a mango sticky rice chichirango. So we're trying to like kind of bring kind of like more flavors that the younger generation will enjoy.
Kind of lead into viral food trends.
Yeah, like that too. Yeah, actually the mango sticky rice was a really popular one. We started it at like a night market actually, and then we kept getting requests over DMs, and someone actually said, oh, can I pre-order it for a wedding that's like 2 years later?
And Devin, how does that affect the bottom line, right? Because it's like viral food trends aren't always a sustainable bet, but maybe you see a peak in orders for a little bit, but put it in context.
So trends are good, but like we said, we actually have our staple items and we don't do our trends too long. We just make smaller items, maybe it might be 1 week, and bring that trend back a few months later. So we don't stick to something for too long because there's so much different items or flavors we can do. The good thing, we also made a banana cream pie mochi. We get these requests nonstop. So at one point you have to stop it. Or you're gonna be making this not every week, every week, every week. So I think the bottom line is it helps. Anything that's new, because again, we have the customers that come in day out. Some want their, again, red bean, but some want to try different things. So we offer a variety and it just helps them. It grows our customer base.
And it's expanding like into butter mochi, which you said was a more recent addition, but is one that people come in maybe looking for. And that's a really interesting tension to me of like, how do you stay true to what you want to do and what this business has been doing since the 1950s, while also incorporating what people might want to get from a place like Fujiya?
Yes, I think that was one of the first things I struggle with is, do we just keep all the traditional items and not change anything and just perfect it? And that's what I think a lot of places in Japan are. They just perfect the craft of what they're doing, and they have a short 3-item menu, but it's just doing that day in, day out. I firmly believe that if in business, if you don't, you know, adapt to your any situation, whether, you know, the clientele, you will probably slowly not be in business. So we always are gladly to take customer requests and, again, try something for 1 or 2 weeks, bring it back, see how it goes. And, you know, I love changes. I love seeing the same people, but I love seeing new people in the store. And I think that's what it's all about, you know, trying to adapt.
Tyler, what do you think about that question? I feel like there's a stereotype of young people that they want to come in and change a lot of things and maybe don't care as strongly about tradition. But how have you thought about the balancing act of this business?
I think tradition is really important. I think that we kind of need to keep the traditional items because it's kind of like, I kind of hope my kids will be able to taste like the red bean, the white bean, and the traditional mochi also. But I think it's good to incorporate new items too, so that they'll kind of bring in the younger generation so they can try the traditional stuff also.
How does it make both of you feel that you are one of two manufacturers of senbei?
You know, it was really sad because across the street actually had an Ota wafer factory too. And the story is that I think the father had passed away again, so they didn't have someone that could take over or really wanted to take over. One in Waipahu, Ishihara, just went out of business. But we want to keep this tradition alive, whether it's mochi, senbei. Again, seeing the customers that come in, and most of them like in the 70s, we had a lady that worked here and she shared her story of she was here as a little girl. And then she ended up working for us because that was the memory. And that's what, you know, we all kind of as humans want to remember, the places we
went as a child, or the flavors or the taste we had. When it goes, then you're kind of like, oh, it's gone, you know. So we want to keep on continuing this tradition. You know, we get a lot of free stuff. So some people will come with two pies. They'll come out with a cracker. And it's really like a family. And like Todd and I mostly like in the back doing production. But we'll look out and we'll see someone. And we'll run out in the front and say hi to them or give a hug. And it's important to connect with them and also just be saying almost like thank you for coming. We're not on the front street on King Street. We're in the back, standalone. That's like besides passion, we're very grateful for our customers. So that connection is, I think for me, I've been in like sales before and I like talking to people. Seeing, again, the familiar faces, but again, new faces. You just like to hear their story. Where are you from? You know, what occasion are you, you know, bringing this for? And, you know, and a lot of our customers actually are not eating 24 mochis. They're packing it up and they're bringing it to, you know, their girl's luncheon or like a wedding or, you know, just giving it to their dentist. So it's awesome to see that with our customers.
It's about relationship building. It's like you are part of this community, and that's what's so important and special about a business that has been around this long. And I can even imagine, like, especially with an older customer base like this, you get to check in on some of these kupuna, right? Like, you get to remind them, let them have those nostalgic feelings.
Imagine if someone can call you by your name and they're like, oh, you know, do I come that often, or just, you know, or am I that special? And we want to treat everybody like special, because I think even service, and, you know, it's a dying art that you can come in and feel welcome and feel happy. Because what can go wrong when you come into a confectionery that you're going to get something sweet and something, you know, tasty? It's not a stressful place to be.
Tyler, what do you think is the biggest lesson you've learned from your dad?
I guess biggest lesson is probably like hard work. Because like when I first started was probably like in high school, and then just like coming after soccer practice and stuff, but staying like hours on end during New Year's, just like trying to fulfill all the orders, like sometimes staying almost like the whole day, because even a couple hours in coming. So probably hard work would be the number one thing.
That was Devin and Tyler Wong of Fujia, Hawaii. They spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender. You know, and we asked if they had favorite mochi flavors. For Devin, it's traditional red bean. Tyler likes peanut butter banana. And a heads up, before big holidays, they do close online orders and restrict purchases to walk-ins. Why is that? Well, they sold 300 platters for Valentine's Day and around 350 for Lunar New Year's. Devin says it's because they try to make sure no one leaves empty-handed. We are all out of time. Up tomorrow, we have a Hanaho show planned around what some regard as a dark time in our history, when thousands of Japanese Americans were sent to internment camps during World War II. Got feedback for us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Look for us on social media, find our archive shows on our website, or look for The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.